I think we should start tomorrow in an orderly development of the resources that we have at ANWR.
A federal review sparks renewed debate on oil development in ANWR. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 12th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage lawyer has advice for Gulf fishermen.
For Louisiana fishermen at this point, it's really a function of figuring out what their losses are and presenting a claim and should be paid.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP, helping unlock Alaska's energy potential.
A large crowd turned out yesterday to give the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service their thoughts about how to manage the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But most of them wanted to talk about something the government says it's not going to consider or respond to, wilderness protection for the coastal plain. There is another meeting today in Fairbanks and a final one next week in Koktovik. APRN Steve Heimel reports.
At 19 million acres, the refuge is bigger than some states. A concerted campaign by wildlife advocates led to the heart of it being set aside right after statehood, years before Congress passed the Wilderness Act. It was already known by then that there was oil there. It was seeping out of some of the cliffs. But within 4 years, commercial quantities of oil were found to the west on state land at Prudhoe Bay. Now that oil is playing out and eyes are once again on that federal land. It would take an act of Congress to allow oil drilling there. In their planning documents, ANWR managers agree they don't have that authority. They say comments about oil drilling or wilderness status for the coastal plain will not be considered. But that is still what everybody wanted to talk about at the scoping meeting. Chuck Knoll, the mayor of Seward, said ANWR was just one national fuel crisis away from being developed. Better to plan for it now than to have it suddenly and brutally done during a national emergency.
But do we want to do that kind of rush development nowadays? Probably not. I don't think anyone in this room would like that. So I submit to you, rather than cutting off development, that instead, please take this message back to the Secretary, to the President, and carbon copy everybody in the Senate. I think we should start tomorrow in an orderly development of the resources that we have at ANWR.
A number of those who spoke did not have titles before their names. They were citizens worried about jobs or concerned for the wildlife and natural values. But the issue of wilderness versus oil was central to all their comments, too. The Fish and Wildlife Service wants to know where to focus its management resources in the future. The current plan is 22 years old and should have been updated 7 years ago. In that time, the numbers of hunters and floaters have remained about the same, but the climate is not, giving the undisturbed refuge increasing value as a source of scientific data. But even the comment about that from Audubon Society National spokeswoman Tildy Walter circled back to the wilderness issue.
The plan should identify the value of the refuge as a scientific benchmark for monitoring climate change in an intact Arctic ecosystem free of the influences of industrial development.
Some have been campaigning on this issue for decades. Bob Childers became an ANWR advocate after surveying it for a gas pipeline endeavor in the 1970s. He says the pure geography of it is compelling. There is no other untouched place in the circumpolar Arctic where mountains come close to the coast.
It really only occurred in two or three places anywhere around the Arctic. And really this one, by then, was really the only one left that wasn't heavily broken up in the primarily by military activities in the Soviet Union.
Those who live there, of course, do not consider the refuge untouched. Sarah James of Arctic Village told the green-shirted federal bureaucrats that she, too, is a manager of that land.
I'm also a manager to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge we're talking about because I lived there all my life. My people live surrounding refuge all their life for thousands of years, except we don't wear green shirts.
And similarly, Tara Sweeney of the Arctic Slope Native Corporation called on the agency to respect the people who inhabit the area.
My ancestry has footprints across the North Slope, including the coastal plain.
They're thousands of years old, not simply for a float trip down within Anwar during the summer.
Sweeney's Inupiat Corporation strongly supports opening the coastal plain to drilling, while Sarah James' Gwich'in tribe strongly urges its protection. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
BP is accepting damages claims as a result of the massive Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Attorneys are weighing options on litigation strategies for fishing industry interests affected by the disaster. But one Anchorage lawyer, who is no stranger to oil-fueled legal challenges, says federal legislation since the Exxon Valdez spill could significantly change litigation procedures. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
BP has posted an 800 number for those filing damages claims stemming from the Gulf spill. News reports indicate that attorneys are mustering in anticipation of defining a strategy for dealing with the massive legal challenges sure to surface along with the blobs of crude now popping up on Alabama beaches. Anchorage attorney David Esting represented Prince William Sound plaintiffs in a massive class action suit filed after the Exxon Valdez ran aground in 1989. But Esting says this time, spill litigation could be different. In 1989, there were severe maritime limitations on the types of compensatory damages a polluter was liable for.
OPA 90 now expands the matrix of the types of losses that are compensable, including lost profits to businesses occurring as a result of the oil spill. So the scramble to prove liability has more or less been eliminated. And the remaining issues that they'll face are the causation in fact issue and the quantification of their losses.
The Oil Pollution Act of 1990, generally referred to as OPA 90, is a federal law prompted by the Exxon Valdez disaster. It amended the Clean Water Act and addressed two shortcomings in federal law. Prior to Exxon Valdez, the United States had little in the way of federal funds marked for oil spill response and lacked a broad definition of compensable damages allowable for those impacted by a spill. Exxon Valdez changed that.
One's always free to file a lawsuit and assert a whole series of legal theories, but you're going to pay lawyers dearly, you can be sure, for doing that. And I think one doesn't really need a lawyer until BP, for whatever reason, says, no, I'm not paying your perfectly legitimate demonstrable claim. At that point, you might need to engage a lawyer. But until you've gone through that process, why would you pay legal fees as opposed to a forensic economist to put the data together for you?
Esting says claimants need first to hire forensic economics experts to collect data on potential business claims.
The causation issue for commercial fishermen, for example, in Louisiana, is already answered because the authorities in Louisiana have closed the fishery because of the oil spill. There's the causation right there. And so for Louisiana fishermen at this point, it's really a function of figuring out what their losses are and presenting a claim and should be paid.
OPA 90 created a response, liability, and compensation regime for any vessel or facility caused pollution in United States navigable waters. The law also expanded the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to provide up to $2.7 billion for cleanup of an individual incident and created the National Pollution Funds Center, which is charged with recovering costs from liable parties. OPA 90 is put to good use in Alaska and elsewhere. If no one claims liability for a spill, the Coast Guard takes charge using the Oil Spill Trust Fund for costs. Petty Officer Gerald Hawley is a pollution investigator with the Coast Guard in Anchorage.
We'll go out and investigate spills that usually they're ones that it's called a mystery spill. We go out if we'll find the responsible party, make sure that they do their cleanup as they're supposed to. There is no responsible party, or that the responsible party, if they're not doing the job that they're supposed to, we can actually take control of the case and direct all cleanup actions.
Attorney Esting says OPA 90 clears roadblocks for damages claimants, like Louisiana shrimpers, for instance.
To say, here are my catch records for the last 3 or 4 years, and here's the net income that I earned from that catch record. And this year, I haven't caught and won't catch any of those shrimp. And so if I average my income for the last 4 years and to say that's what I would have made this year, write me a check.
Has OPA 90 been tested in this way before? It hasn't, has it?
OPA 90 was used and dealt with at some length by only one circuit court case involving a gasoline spill from a marina. and it was tested and seemed to work fine.
Still, the magnitude of the reach of the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico has not been imagined yet. Petty Officer Hawley says some Alaska Pollution Control investigators have volunteered to go to the Gulf. Attorney Esting says there's no reason today that claimants would have to wait years for compensation. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Governor Parnell today signed a bill designed to encourage Cook Inlet producers to pump gas year-round into underground storage facilities. The sponsor, Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, says the public and South Central utilities are concerned about a possible shortage of fuel in the future, especially in times of peak demands during the winter. He says those within the industry recognize that storage will become a critical component to meet demands.
Production volumes are fairly constant through the year. However, consumer demands are variable, very erratic. In the summer, very, very low demand, and then cold days in the winter, very, very high demand. The need for storage is to reconcile the two. When you can produce at a level flow over the year, and if you can store some of that, you think about it, having a warehouse to put some of that gas in, that on those peak demands in the winter, you can have access to the new gas being produced, but you can also go to your warehouse and pull gas out of your warehouse to meet those peak demands.
The gas would be stored in depleted wells within Cook Inlet. The bill establishes a regulatory system for the Department of Natural Resources to use for leasing those wells and for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to use in considering the rates they approve. Hawker says that in the past, the RCA has been seen as more of the problem than the solution.
Unfortunately, the RCA has failed to sanction a couple of major long-term contracts. And by failing to sanction these contracts, it has contributed to the utilities not having adequate gas on hand to deliver on those cold winter days.
Hawker says the bill requires the commission to balance decisions to deny a rate request against the needs of consumers who might face fuel shortages. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Prince of Wales Island becomes a new destination for a small cruise ship company.
They're a cruise ship of clients who are very respectful of the places they visit, and they have a real interest in going places where no one else goes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
A TransCanada official says its North Slope natural gas pipeline project faces major financial hurdles. In a presentation to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday, TransCanada Vice President of Alaska Development, Tony Palmer, described what he calls significant challenges to move the project it's pursuing with partner ExxonMobil forward. TransCanada estimates the cost of building a gas line from the North Slope to Alberta at between $32 and $41 billion and a line to Valdez at $20 to $26 billion. Palmer said either one will be a 75% debt-funded.
Multiply those numbers by 75% and think about the amount of debt that must be raised to finance this project. It is 2 to 3 times the largest private energy project in the world ever. The Papua New Guinea project today is financed with $14 billion worth of debt. This project is going to have double or triple that.
Palmer said a proposed increase in a U.S. government loan guarantee from $18 to $30 billion and access to the Federal Financing Bank are key to project success.
Traditionally, pipelines during construction are funded with bank financing during construction, then there's a takeout loan for operations. In this case, because of the scale of the project, without the federal loan guarantee, you will have to go to the bond markets. Bond markets are not familiar with taking any completion risk.
TransCanada is in the midst of a 90-day open season during which the company is negotiating with gas producers to carry their product to a market. The success of the open season largely hinges on what producers believe will happen with the price of gas by the time the proposed pipeline would go into operation in 2020. Palmer said the current $4 price of natural gas is too low given project costs and shipping rates.
The pipeline tolls are somewhere in the 280 to 350 range for going to Alberta and 245 to 315 range to go to Valdez. So you can see that if you're a customer, you want to be able to pay that toll and have some margin for yourself as well.
Palmer says the open season has not yielded any bids to date, but that it's standard practice for shippers to file in the final days of the process. The open season concludes July 30th. Governor Sean Parnell was keynote speaker at the Juneau Police Department's annual Peace Officers Memorial Observance yesterday on the lawn of the Alaska State Museum. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
The risks Alaska's law enforcement personnel face hit home for Governor Parnell recently when his high school classmate, Anchorage Police Officer Jason Allen, was seriously wounded on the job. Parnell says Allen's reaction after he thanked him typifies the sacrifices police make for their communities.
He humbly pointed out that his fellow law enforcement officers perform that same service with the same heart, take those same risks, and make those sacrifices every day.
In 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed Public Law 87726, making the week of May 15th National Police Week. Parnell signed a proclamation this week recognizing the date in Alaska. He says police officers play an important role protecting U.S. citizens.
These men and women chose to dedicate their lives to law enforcement because they understood the value of safety and they were willing to protect us. They wanted to protect human life and liberty and the rule of law, and we do the same when we remember them.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave?
Officers from the U.S. Forest Service, Alaska State Troopers, JPD, and Capital City Fire and Rescue were part of the ceremony. Juneau Police Lieutenant Troy Wilson's daughter Zoe sang the national anthem. Mayor Bruce Botello, who read a proclamation of his own, thanked all of those involved in Juneau's law enforcement community, including judges, prosecutors, and advocates.
All of you are part of what makes our justice system in America and in Alaska the best in the world.
But in the end, the ceremony was a chance to remember fallen officers. Since territorial days, more than 40 Alaska police officers have died in the line of duty, including four in Juneau. Officer Donald Dull was accidentally shot by a court bailiff in 1964. Richard Adair and Jimmy Kennedy died in a shootout with a mentally ill man in 1979. And most recently, Carl Reiches died during a training accident in 1992. Following the memorial, a wreath was laid at Adair's gravesite at Evergreen Cemetery. Juneau Police Captain Jerry Nankervis says he always takes a moment during the Peace Officers Memorial to remember Reiches and local Alaska State Troopers C.E. Swackhammer and Bob Biddick, who died 2 years later in a plane crash.
It's my time to just sit and think about them and say, but they're for the grace of God.
Surprisingly, Nankervis says he doesn't think much about the risks he takes every day on the job.
No, it's probably in the back of my wife's mind, and maybe even my kids every now and then, but no, it's not. You just do what you do and be as safe as you can, understanding that there are risks that you're going to be taking on and situations you're going to step into that you're obligated to, but the folks here in this town deserve that.
Former JPD Sergeant Tom Bates also was remembered during the ceremony. Even though he died in a home accident this past December, Police Chief Greg Browning said everyone with the department felt it was important to honor him as if he had fallen in the line of duty. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Thawing permafrost is increasing methane emissions across the north, but the potent greenhouse gas may be a viable energy source. That was the message of University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher Katie Walter Anthony in a recent presentation on methane emissions. Walter Anthony described how warming of permafrost lakes is freeing up a new food for methane-producing bacteria.
The food, the substrate that the microbes are using to create methane was locked up in the freezer in the permafrost for tens of thousands of years. It's been thawing out very recently, and microbes have just turned it into methane.
The greenhouse gas production from the breakdown of ancient organic matter is likened to the burning of fossil fuels, and Walter Anthony says it could offer an oil alternative in some cases.
There's methane coming to the surface that could potentially be tapped into. Now, whether that means adding a shallow well or just capturing the methane as it's already rising to the surface, those are potentially interesting and valuable questions for people who live in rural areas.
Walter Anthony says it's not practical to harness dispersed bubbling from lakes, but more concentrated seeps have potential.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game captured and collared a problem brown bear in Sitka over the weekend. Biologists can now use radial signals to track the animal and her two cubs and possibly prevent problems before they start. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Area management biologist Phil Mooney darted the sow Friday evening about 6 p.m. near the Cove Marina on Halibut Point Road. Two Sitka police officers, Ryan Silva and Kyle Ferguson, assisted Mooney with the darting. Other officers kept spectators back from the area. By 7, the sow was fully sedated and lying down in the beach sedges where she and the cubs had been browsing. With the sow incapacitated, Mooney and the officers were able to safely dart the cubs. All three animals were given red and yellow ear tags and were on their feet again by 10:30 that evening. The sow now also sports a white collar with a global positioning system receiver and a VHF radio signal. The GPS records the bear's position 3 times an hour. The VHF allows Mooney to track her at any time rather than relying on resident sightings or a stakeout. Although this sow has been into garbage, her behavior remains cautious. The problem is the male cub, who at over a year old and around 100 pounds is becoming quite brazen with people and dogs. Mooney believes the cub's confidence is mostly derived from having a large and powerful mother at his back. He says it's becoming apparent that the male cub is leading the way into problem situations with people and animals, and the sow is following in his defense. The behavior has been observed elsewhere, both in urban and wild environments, by biologists. Mooney says he contacted other researchers Saturday morning to discuss the situation, and the department may consider dispatching the male cub as a possible resolution. Until Fish and Game arrives at a decision about the male cub, Mooney says he can use the radio collar to push the sow out of town. With or without the male cub in tow, Mooney believes this sow can find better territory than Halibut Point Road. The radio collar will fall off the sow automatically on September 15th this year. Mooney says he'll collect the collar at that time, download the GPS data, and create a map of the bear's movement this summer. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A small cruise ship will be making 2 test visits to Prince of Wales Island this summer. While a handful of small cruise lines have visited the island over the past number of years, large cruise ships have bypassed Prince of Wales in favor of nearby ports like Ketchikan. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
This weekend, the Safari Quest will dock in Klawak, bringing with it a pack of travel writers and adventure travel industry representatives. American Safari Cruises and Intersea Discovery CEO Dan Blanchard says his company will make 2 trips to Prince of Wales this summer in advance of next summer, when the small cruise line is scheduled to make 18 stops.
We decided that we really wanted a highly adventuresome product, not a soft adventure, but an option for soft or high adventure on board and off the vessel. And Prince of Wales is off the beaten track, and that's really what we wanted.
Blanchard says he first returned to Prince of Wales to take part in a tourism summit on the island last summer. He says he was surprised by what he saw.
It had been maybe 10 years since I'd been out to Prince of Wales, and I have to tell you, they have done a tremendous job of cleaning up that island. You know, it used to be that there was just a lot of remnants of some of the logging industry and such that's gone on, and it is beautiful out there. I was really impressed.
The Safari Quest, which is visiting Klawak this summer, carries 22 guests. Next summer, the company will dispatch Intersea Discoveries vessels to the island, which carry 49 passengers. Still, it's a far cry from the larger cruise ships that sail the Inside Passage each summer. They can pack in upwards of 2,000 passengers. Blanchard says the size of his company's ships allows the cruise line to try out different ports of call, like Prince of Wales.
That's the joy of really the small ship thing, is we're not talking about thousands of people. We're talking, you know, anywhere between 49 and 80 people. So the big infrastructure that the cruise ships require isn't there, and that's the very reason we go there, actually.
Well, Prince of Wales Island has either been unwilling or unable to significantly break into the cruise ship market. The island has successfully attracted independent travelers to its numerous lodges. Klawak City Administrator Leslie Isaac says he expects some growth in the cruise industry on Prince of Wales, but he does not foresee the industry becoming a major economic driver on the island.
As long as it's done right, I think it can be a supplement to the local economy. I don't think it can be a catalyst for growing and expanding the economy that we have here on the or here in Klawak, but rather it can be a nice avenue, a nice outlet for our local artists to be able to sell their wares and to have a market off the island for their local native artwork that they produce.
They're a cruise ship of clients who are very respectful of the places they visit, and they have a real interest in going places where no one else goes.
Prince of Wales Visitors Committee Chairperson Jeannie McFarland says the committee has so far been resistant to the idea of attracting larger cruise ships to the island. She says the Safari and Intersea Discovery ships and their clientele are better suited for Prince of Wales.
Our island is fast becoming a destination for many people, and because of that, this committee was formed through the Chamber of Commerce because we want to decide how visitors come to our island and what they do here, and our interest is in those who want to know about the nature and the culture of our island.
The Safari Quest is slated to visit Prince of Wales this Saturday and Sunday. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.